It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us after the long holiday weekend. It's Thanksgiving Monday, also the first day of deer season, and we're still not back to normal yet. Now, a lot of folks are back to work today. Some students are back to school, but not all. Many school districts stick another day of vacation onto the end of Thanksgiving because of the first day of deer season. By tomorrow, we'll pretty much be back to normal after the holiday weekend. And by my goodness, didn't it go by in a blur, huh? Wow. Thanksgiving suddenly seems like a long time ago. It was just last Thursday. Hey, we have a good program today. It's a book talk day. It's one of our more popular regular features here on the It's Your Turn program. A little bit later, we're going to be chatting with Matthew Kramer. Matthew is the musical director and conductor of the Butler Symphony, and they will be presenting their holiday concert this weekend, this Saturday. So that's always a very popular concert, one of the usual sellouts, and I hope there's still tickets left. We'll talk with Matthew about that a little bit later. Find out what's on the program. I think there's some singers from area high schools who are going to be involved along with the symphony, but we'll get the details from the maestro a little bit later. Our first guest sits right across the console from me, and it's always good to welcome Laurie Hinterleiter from the Butler Area Public Library, the director there. Laurie, good to see you again.
Great to see you. It's hard to believe it's been so many months since I was last here.
I was looking back at the schedule. In fact, Laurie and I were just laughing because, you know, you think back on some of the books that we've done. I am nearing 200 now, by the way, on Book
I'm
Talk.
I'm sure.
And, you know, you think, when did we do that one? It must have been a year or so ago. And then you look, and it's like 6 years, you know. We were last together in February reviewing one of my favorite books of the year, quite frankly, Flight of Dreams.
It was a great book, mm-hmm. A great title. I've recommended it to several people since then.
Historical fiction, for those who weren't lucky enough to be with us in February. It was about the
flight of the Hindenburg.
Mm-hmm, the Hindenburg, which, of course, exploded and burned on attempting to land in New Jersey. But it was a fascinating story of spies and
intrigue, subterfuge.
Yeah, we had the Nazis on there. And, of course, it was a German airship,
correct,
the Hindenburg. The most astonishing thing to me that I came away with from that reading that book, Flight of Dreams, was the incredible number of people who survived.
I know, you didn't think about that. I never realized that until I read the book.
I didn't either. We've
all
seen
those. Just always heard about the explosion and
that newsreel footage of the, you know, the fireball,
yes.
And it's still up in the air when it's they hooked it up to like a landing mast or something, and it isn't there yet, and it's blowing up, and there's that, you know, that announcer, hold the humanity.
Yes.
Most of the people actually survived.
I know. I was so surprised when I read that and was able to delve into that a little deeper.
It was a great book. It was a great selection. And this month, the Butler Area Public Library has selected for a discussion Before We Were Yours by Lisa Wingate. Also historical fiction, the same genre.
I know. I seem to be on a roll with this historical fiction
last
few
times. That's okay with me.
I know that you enjoy that.
I enjoy historical fiction, yeah. This is a sobering story, isn't it?
It is. It's not the easiest story to read in part, mm-hmm. In some levels, but at the same time, there's some uplifting aspects to it, I guess. Another part of history that I was really not familiar with as well.
Well, I didn't know the details. I knew from a book called Orphan Train,
mm-hmm.
That we actually reviewed here a few years back. I knew about this, sending children, in many cases against their will, or certainly without their consent, to foster homes and adoptive homes. And it's kind of sad because adoption and foster care are such wonderful things.
They are.
And to have these, you know, bad people who give them a black eye, and we certainly had a a baddie in this book.
The epitome of baddie, probably.
Yes, yes. Boy, I'm just drawing a blank on her name. Oh, Georgia Tan.
Yes, Miss Tan.
Tan with two N's, T-A-N-N, who ran a so-called orphanage. It was really a corrupt adoption place, a moneymaker for her in Memphis, Tennessee, from the 30s up through the 50s. And this is really true. There really was a Georgia Tan.
There was, and the Tennessee Children's Home Society actually existed. It's amazing when you read this story and just some of the other references how long this actually existed.
It was, and I don't watch 60 Minutes all the time. Years ago I used to with regularity, but I don't know, things change. And it's just not, in today's day and age on TV. No, it isn't. It isn't.
It's not the same.
First of all, it's, you know, their seasons nowadays are like 10 weeks long. You never know when you're going to get a repeat. And 60 Minutes, you never know when it's going to start.
I was going to say, after football games, you never know if it's going to be 10 minutes late, an hour late, you're never sure.
Yeah, and so I haven't lost interest. I think it's still a good program. But anyway, the reason I mention this, 60 Minutes did an expose on this woman.
Yes.
Georgia Tan and the, what is it, the Tennessee Children's Home Society Orphanage. I would love to see it. I'm sure they ripped her to shreds, you know, because she was an evil person.
She was not a nice lady, that is for sure.
Mm-hmm. There was also, I found out, a nonfiction book written about this whole scandal.
Yes.
About 10 years ago. So we're dealing with something that really happened here, and it's really kind of gut-wrenching to think about it. So that's the basis.
Yes.
Lisa Wingate, however, has taken that and based her novel, her fictional novel, Before We Were Yours, on this whole situation. A couple of things about the, by the way, this is just published, right? Earlier this year.
Yes, it's a newer title, and it's gotten great attention.
Mm-hmm.
Great attention. And I think after we talk about it, you can see why. Earlier in the year. It must have been early published, I think, earlier this year.
Yeah. So how does, give us a little bit of the secret background here. How does a library find out about, because this is a brand new book. In fact, the copy that I have, it's like brand new. You know, when I opened it for the first time, it cracked.
I know, same here.
So you obviously your book clubs haven't done this yet. It's too soon for that.
No, we haven't gotten it to our book club readers yet, but I'm sure that it will be one of the more popular choices. As far as how we select books or for things like this program or other, we have lots of resources, some of them being official publications, library journals, those types of things. There's a wonderful resource that we actually have at the library that patrons can pick up a free copy called Book Pages, and it does a lot of reviews about all the genres, but there's also usually a section for book club choices. And then, you know, one of the greatest things is just by word of mouth, by patrons, fellow colleagues, staff members.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where this one came. I was trying to decide, you know, months before we come and talk, what I should read, and I was, you know, debating upon some things, and a couple of patrons who had read it earlier in the year and staff members said, you should read this, knowing that it was a little bit difficult to read as far as a little heart-wrenching, but it's a great story.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. Lisa Wingate, I did just a cursory background check on her. By the photograph in the back of the book, she seems to be a pretty young woman. I don't know how old she is, and you never ask that, of course. But she's had an astonishing output of books. Unless this is a really, really old picture, she's really been prolific.
I would say that she probably is a fairly young author, a newer author in some regards when it's all relative to some of the others in the genre.
She's won a lot of awards, including the Pat Conroy Southern Book Prize, which is the only one that I've really heard of, and that's pretty prestigious Prize, but she's won a bunch of other ones as well.
The Christie Award is for inspirational fiction or inspirational writing. I recognize that one. Some of the other ones I think are more local, regional awards.
She started out, according to the biography, in fact, I think this might have been on her website. She started out writing at a very young age. Now, I kind of chuckled when I first read this. She said she was in elementary, like first or second grade, and her teacher, whom she named, said, well, I expect to see your name underneath a magazine article sometime in the future. And I thought, well, now, wait a minute. A first grade kid, maybe sixth grade, he could tell somebody that. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, she started out when she actually started publishing, doing so-called inspirational novels.
Yes.
But she's transferred now over to popular fiction, and I don't know whether she's done other historical fiction or whether her earlier books are just, you know, made up out of whole cloth or whatever.
From the books that we have in our collections, most of them have some historical aspect. It might not be as direct as something like the one we're talking about, but I think there's a real trend.
The one thing that I did not see, and it was actually what I started out looking for, was there any history or any even, you know, third or fourth degree connection with adoption or foster care in her family, because she seems to write with such affection, such empathy for adoption and foster care that I thought, man, there must be something in her family.
I know. I have not come across any of the common ties, the common denominator. I know that she read a lot of interviews and firsthand accounts, but I haven't been able to put a connection together either.
Well, it could be something along the plot lines of this novel, because it's very much concerned with adoption and foster care, but also with family secrets.
Yes.
And, you know, it really wasn't until fairly recent times that people did talk a lot about adoption. For one reason or another, good or bad, they kept that kind of under wraps, kept that kind of a family secret. And family secret is a concept that figures very prominently in this book.
Just a slight bit there, Dave.
Now, about the structure. And when we talk about this, I know there are some people that are going to say, oh, that's going to confuse me. I'm going to be all bent out of shape. No. She actually tells two parallel stories.
Yes,
here.
Two different generations, mm-hmm. Two parallel stories that at the end intertwine.
And they are some generations apart.
Yes.
And she alternates back and forth. It's not like you have four chapters of
a chapter at a time.
Yeah. The earlier time period is 1939. Mm-hmm. And then the latter day time period, the alternate chapters are, it just says the present day.
I was going to say present day, whatever year you would like to pick in present day. But
that's going to be 75 years ago in that general range, if you're trying to get an idea of.
Basically, it would be, you know, a couple generations difference in the characters. So.
Which also figures prominently in the in the plot. And trust me, at least I didn't think so. I was never confused. I've read parallel story novels where my head was spinning and my eyeballs were spinning.
I have too, and I've actually had some that I've actually needed to make notes, almost like flow charts, and trying to keep them together. And some where there are multiple characters that they do this with, this style. But I am like you. You just knew after you started that it was going to be, you know, the next character back and forth, and I didn't find it hard to follow as well.
And you also knew that at some point these two stories were going to intersect.
Yes, yes.
It had to be, you know, otherwise.
It was fate. You knew from the very first page.
Didn't spoil anything, but you were just waiting for it to happen.
You didn't know how, but you knew that eventually this was going to come together.
If you're joining us a little bit late, that's fine, folks. It's a book talk day here on It's Your Turn, and Laurie Hinterleiter is here. Laurie is the director longtime director, actually, now, of the Butler Area Public Library. And they have chosen the historical fiction novel Before We Were Yours by Lisa Wingate. Priceless picture on the cover, by the way.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. And I don't know if you recall, it was toward the end of the book that you actually, if you read that part, you could then realize where the picture was coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll take a quick break here and then talk about some of the characters, which we really haven't mentioned yet. One of our sponsors on the program today, folks, is Miller's Shoes. Hey, this is the last day. In fact, we're in the last hours now of their after Thanksgiving sale. There's still time. There's still time. They're open today up until 5 o'clock. But the after Thanksgiving sale is a pretty good deal at Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street, downtown. 20% off shoes, boots, and slippers. 20% off their entire regular stock of athletic shoes. 20% off the entire stock of men's and women's Nike, New Balance, Saucony, Rockport, Keds, Skechers, Easy Spirit, Asics, ProPet, and more. What about slippers? Where do you find slippers these days? That's a wonderful Christmas gift, by the way. A pair of slippers. Men's and women's, the entire stock, 20% off. Through today, through 5 o'clock today. And they've got Daniel Green and Foam Treads and Lomo, other famous brands. Speaking of which, at Miller's Shoes downtown, celebrating their 125th anniversary, by the way, this year, you'll find name brands that you know are going to last. Timberland shoes and boots, toe warmers, boots and totes made in Canada. Rockports, all Rockports, 20% off. Oh, and by the way, America's favorite comfort shoes, SAS shoes. Miller's is also your local headquarters for them. And it's 15% off the entire stock of women's SAS. It's the after Thanksgiving sale going on right now through the end of business today. That's through 5 o'clock today at Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. We're talking with Laurie Hinterleiter about Before We Were Yours. It's the book talk selection for this month by Lisa Wingate. So we know that the story alternates back and forth.
Yes.
It starts out in Memphis, Tennessee.
Correct.
And this is the earlier generation, yes. So it's 1939.
Correct.
How does the novel start out, Laurie?
It starts out by having a recount of a mother who was giving birth to a child and didn't, you know, was sadly... live birth and mm-hmm. a lot of struggle there, and that's
maybe it was dead whenever the baby
exactly.
was born.
Exactly, yeah. And so just description of that and the scenario, and that's it's just the author and the main character then refers. This is you know basically the start of mm-hmm. their life.
Yeah. And even if you didn't know, and we've given folks a little bit of the background here, I didn't know any of this when I started reading it. It's pretty poignant.
Yes.
Because it's in the, it opens in the delivery room. You are told by the author that this is, it's a very upscale hospital. So
yes.
We know that it's a wealthy
family.
Woman who's mm-hmm. About to give birth. It turns out that her husband is not there, but her father is.
Yes.
Waiting outside the delivery room, and the obstetrician has to go out and tell the grandfather, your daughter's probably going to be okay, but we couldn't save the baby. We lost the baby. And it turns out this wasn't the first time this had happened.
No, there had been a history of stillbirths or miscarriages.
Mm-hmm. And we learn from the grandfather, we're not spilling any secrets here,
mm-mm.
folks. This is all set up in the very beginning. We learn from the grandfather who almost pleadingly says, you know, well, you know, they can try again. And the doctor says, not a good idea, not a good idea. She probably
her
wouldn't
life
make
would,
it.
Her life yeah. would be in danger.
And the grandfather says, but she's our only daughter. And, you know, to continue the family line in that. The OBGYN says, I understand, but
still not a good idea.
It's not going to happen. Yeah. But he wants to give him a lot of information so that he can tell the father, who is not there for a good reason, by the way. He's not an absentee father. But we don't know that in the beginning.
Not at the beginning.
No. So this is Memphis, Tennessee, by the way, right?
Yes.
Where this is set, this particular story at least, 1939. We soon meet, actually, the central character. It's not this woman who's just given birth.
No, no, it's not. 12-year-old. When you first read that, you think that this is going to be the woman who has just lost her baby, but it's not.
That's what I did, yeah. No, it turns out the central character in this one of these two parallel stories is a 12-year-old girl.
Yes, her name is Rill. R-I-L-L, Foss.
Can't say that I ever came across that name before.
No, there are several names in this book that I'm not familiar with.
Do you think it's a southern name, Rill?
I don't know. I think some of them definitely are, but I'm not sure. I didn't have time to research that just to see if these are common names, but I suspect some of them were.
The other central character, and we'll get to that story in a few minutes here, from the other story that's being told here. Her name is Avery Stafford. Avery. Yes. Now, I can see that. That sounds like a southern name. It sounds like a wealthy name.
And it sounds like a present day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wasn't sure about Rill. Rill Foss, who is 12 years of age, but is very much an adult. She has four younger siblings, and she takes care of them a lot.
I was going to say, no matter what part of this story, she is always basically an adult and the caretaker of all of her siblings in whatever role that it ends up being.
Well, let's go into a little bit more detail. Again, we're just setting the stage here, folks. Please, don't worry. We almost never spill the beans on a novel. I think I've done that a time or two. But,
we'll try not to do that.
No,
with this one.
We don't want to ruin it for you because it's a very good read. But the biggest initial action that occurs after this, we witness this tragic stillbirth, is with Rill, who, as we mentioned, she has four younger siblings.
Yes.
2-year-old boy, and the rest are all girls, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And they live with their parents. Talk about your strange name.
Yes.
Briny
and Queenie.
Queenie. Briny is the father. Queenie is the mother of this rather ragtag family group.
And they're often referred to as river gypsies. Mm-hmm. They live basically on a shanty boat and travel. They try to keep to themselves sometimes just for safety factors, but they're also part of the bigger river gypsy group.
Mm-hmm. By the way, this is on the Mississippi. The Mississippi River passes through Memphis, Tennessee.
Yes, yeah, so they travel back and forth on the river, depending on the seasons or whatever situations they may come along. Mm-hmm. Often they'll stay dock at certain areas for a while.
I just saw not too long ago, earlier this year, an Alfred Hitchcock film that was set mainly on a riverboat, and I couldn't help going back to that because, it's classic.
Yes,
Hitchcock.
Yes.
You're scared to death the whole time you're watching it. But they're obviously very poor.
Yes.
Shanty boat, they call it.
Shanty boat. Very little food to eat. By the description, you can just tell. Very little clothing. Mm-hmm. Shanty boat, just not even in the greatest of shape to run. But
now, the first major event that we find Rill Foss involved in is her mother, Queenie, is pregnant again, obviously. They have a lot of kids already.
Yes, with
She's
twins.
Pregnant with twins, and she goes into premature labor, and Briny rushes her off to the hospital, leaving Rill on the houseboat, the shanty boat, in charge of all the rest of the kids.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. And one of the last things her father says is, take care of her brother and sisters.
And then the next thing that happens is pretty shocking.
Yes. I don't know what the time period of day, maybe. I'm not sure the time, but the police, I guess it was the police and maybe some other gentleman. I'm not really sure. Now, after you read the story, I'm not sure who they were, if they were actually policemen or...
Some sort of enforcement authority, maybe sheriff or constables or something.
Yeah. Came aboard the shanty boat, which Rill and her siblings were very leery of and tried to hide because they, being sort of gypsies on the river, they were always trying to escape potential situations, so they were very familiar and very cautious.
They certainly smelled trouble when these guys
came
on the boat.
Yes, they had no doubt that there was something going to happen. And so whatever group this was, sheriff or whatever authorities, they came, and after a struggle with most of them, took them. Rather violently in some regards, took them then to this Tennessee children's home.
Yeah, forcibly removed these kids,
the
oldest of which was 12.
And the youngest 2, mm-hmm. under the premise that they were going to be able to see their parents, who they had not seen and had not gotten any report or word from what happened with the birth of their siblings. So they were taken there. And as they were on their way, Rill became more and more aware or afraid, suspected that this really wasn't how this was going to end, that they weren't sure if they were going to be able to be reunited with their parents.
And this Tennessee Children's Home Society orphanage, it's a stretch to call it an orphanage, really. It was a dump. But it was under the direction of this, the villain whom we mentioned at the beginning.
Georgia Tan.
T-A-N-N. Who was a real piece of work, a real nasty person. She was running an adoption and fostering corruption ring.
Yes.
She was selling these kids.
And even when they picked up Rill and her siblings, they gathered up some other children along the way. Mm-hmm. And many of them, some of them were truly orphans, but many of them were not. They were just in similar situations to Rill's family and were not kids so much, but were tricked into or just, you know, taken over.
So they thought for a while that they were eventually going to go back to their riverboat home. It was the only home they ever knew, poor as it was. But as it turns out, they never did, and they never found out what happened to their mom and the twins who were going to be born. Nothing. No info. How were they treated at this so-called orphanage, this Tennessee Children's Home Society?
It was horrendous. This is part of the book when you talk about heart-wrenching.
You cringe. You really do.
It's really heart-tugging, but I'm sure very true according to the historical, the facts that we know. But horrendously, when they first got there, they were yanked by their ears and hair and different things and basically thrown into the basement in a dark, musty, damp, mildewy room. The whole family, they weren't really allowed to be in public or with the other children, and stayed there for quite a while. Meals were hardly meals. All of them in this home basically lived on mush or some kind of grits, but ate very little. Filthy conditions, and just a lot of abuse, physical abuse, later in the story, sexual abuse, just verbal abuse, really, really dark stuff.
Not Rill, the 12-year-old, but one of her younger sisters was raped while she was there by one of the orphanage workers.
Basically, all of the workers that Georgia Tan had under her were as evil or just as were able to be manipulated by her to...
So her plan was, her modus operandi, she looked for families who wanted to adopt kids or foster kids.
Who had the wealth, the money to do that.
Wealthy people, and she charged them. And which would have been bad enough if they were being ripped off, but in many cases she would go back later.
Yes,
and say, how'd you like to keep these kids? More money, please.
She would manipulate the system or tell them that the paperwork wasn't final and they needed more money, and just different stories, but targeted, whether it be politicians, they refer to a lot of movie stars, really prominent names.
Mm-hmm. And we begin to see rather early on how this ties in with that opening scene where
yes.
the wealthy young mother gave birth to a stillborn child, the latest in a long line of stillborn children, and she was told she could never have any more.
Yes.
And so we kind of know where that's going.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's one of the parallel
yes.
stories. Now the other one is we go from 1939 to the present day. So let's 75 years later, let's say, roughly.
And you meet Avery Stafford, who is 30 or in her 30s,
mm-hmm.
a lawyer, worked in Washington and different things for many years for her family.
Very smart, very well-to-do, very wealthy. Her father's a senator.
Yes, and a long history of politics and government service.
Well, I certainly wondered when we first meet her, how the heck she's going to fit into this whole story.
I know. She's a little rebellious in her own mm-hmm. Way.
Now, a little bit, and again, we're not spilling the beans here, but this is just set up for getting these two parallel stories underway. We find out that she's rather rebellious and of an independent mind. Her father, in fact, now that I think about it, it opens with her going back to South Carolina.
Yes.
Because her father is ailing, they're kind of grooming her to take over his job.
They're not sure how his health, how things will play out, so they're mm-hmm. basically setting up a plan B, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. I thought of the Kennedy family.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Kennedy, I'm talking about the older
yes.
Joe Sr., he always wanted his son Joe to be president, and it was grooming him. He's the one that was killed in World War II.
And there were only girls in the family.
Mm-hmm.
She was the youngest, I believe, of three.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was their choice to perhaps take over if something happened. So they had called her back home.
And she wasn't sure she wanted to do this.
No.
I'm not sure I want to be a senator. I want to take over the family business, so to speak.
No, and obviously the lifestyle and the very not-so-private public life.
Mm-hmm. There's also a bit of a romantic angle here. She, and I didn't quite understand this. Maybe you can help me out here from a woman's point of view, Laurie. She's going back home to South Carolina. Aiken is the name of the town.
Yes.
Aiken, I don't know whether that's a real town. Sounds like it could be a town in South Carolina. She's going back there. Her father's ailing. They're not sure whether he's going to live or how long. She also is engaged.
Yes, to a member of this society, that they grew up in, mm-hmm. a fellow member, a young man that she had grown up with, were great friends with. And
known him since childhood.
Yes, and at some time, I think more the families probably decided that they should marry.
Mm-hmm. His name was Elliot.
Yes.
Another good choice of a name. It suggests,
Yes.
I could just see it on the wedding napkins now. Avery and Elliot.
Yes.
We are rich.
Well, even their respective mothers were Honeybee and Bitsy. You never did really find out their formal names.
Not sure that I wanted to. So she's showing her independence here as well. She's not sure she wants to follow in her father's footsteps, even though everybody in the family is grooming her and think that's what she's going to do. And she's also not sure she wants to go through with a marriage to this longtime guy, Elliot.
Correct.
She doesn't think she loves him. So why the heck would she marry him?
Well, there again, it depends on, in this political setting, this very powerful family, perhaps their family, parents have more influence over their own wishes.
I guess. Just kind of wondered at that. I thought, well, what does he just say? Hey, the guy, you know, he's a nice guy. I've known him all my life. I'm not going to marry him.
I always thought if the story didn't play out the way it did, I also thought that perhaps if she had wondered in no other directions, I don't think that would have ever happened. Some way, somehow, she would have chosen to end that relationship.
So, guys, let us stop for a quick break here, and then we'll pick up the next line of what happens. The book is Before We Were Yours. It's a New York Times bestseller, published earlier this year. It's a pretty new book, obviously, although we are at the tail end of November here. So Lisa Wingate is the author, and we'll pick up our conversation about the book coming up here on It's Your Turn on WISR, right after a quick word from our good friends at Goin' Postal Butler. Goin' Postal Butler. Have you heard about this business, folks? They're just off Newcastle Road in the Shockey Mini Storage. I'll tell you where it is. It's right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants. Those two restaurants are kind of side by side, right behind them on Newcastle Road. We'll give you a phone number in a minute. You can get more information about their services. So what do at Goin' Postal Butler? They package your items for shipping. What a great service this is. Even if you just have one, I mean, you know, it's kind of a bag to hunt for the paper, the wrapping paper. You need that special tape and mailing labels. Well, but boy, if you have several packages, a lot of folks do this time of year, it's a great service. They package your items for shipping. You can ship any way you want. FedEx, UPS, U.S. Postal Service, that's your choice. Goin' Postal will handle it for you. They also offer copying service, scanning, faxing, mailbox rentals, greeting cards, lottery tickets. They even have an official notary there. Sometimes you need something notarized before it goes out, right? Get it done right there. Phone them at 724-841-0044. 724-841-0044. Your neighborhood friendly shipping center. Goin' Postal Butler. We'll be back to talk more with Laurie right after these words. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Welcome back, friends. It's a book talk day. Laurie Hinterleiter is here. Laurie is the director of the Butler Area Public Library. I've been carrying on here as if assuming that everyone knows where the Butler Area Public Library is. It's on North McCain Street, downtown.
It is, right beside Thompson Miller Funeral Home. Mm-hmm. There are neighbors across the street from the First United Methodist Church, and not too far from the Maradon Museum.
No, and it's just half a block off Main Street, so
yes.
Very easy to get to, and remodeled and added on to, it must be 10, 12 years ago now. Huh?
It's actually been, the major renovation was about 15 years ago.
Time flies.
And then we've had some sub-renovations since then. So yeah.
It's really nice. And by the way, that major renovation was accomplished just splendidly because the architects were able to join two existing buildings.
Luther Hall.
With different brickwork. And it just looks terrific.
You know? It's amazing. People don't really realize when they're in there that it's actually true.
And someone told me once, this is a little bit off track, but someone once told me that that whole structure actually started out as a private home.
It wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me.
No, it's added on to a number of times. You know, it doesn't look anything like that.
Well, and if you recall, years ago, the Fridoli building was in our part of our parking lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it has gone through many, many changes.
Well, whoever came up with the idea to put those, there's so many other things, but to put those lights in the sidewalk, that was brilliant. That really dresses it up at night.
It makes it nice to drive by.
We're talking about the New York Times bestselling novel. It's historical fiction. It's based on something really bad that happened for decades, actually, in Tennessee. Corrupted adoption and foster care scheme masterminded by this person called Georgia Tan. And there really was a Georgia Tan. I found online a picture of her. And I want to tell you, it's like central casting. If you were trying to come up with somebody that looked evil and nefarious, it would be that picture. Not a good person.
Which I guess is, in a way, kind of fitting and a good thing, because if you saw someone else, at least you can say she looks like.
It's interesting because this whole adoption scheme, and I thought about this when I was reading the book, and I dismissed it in rather short order. What if, because Georgia Tan, and there were a couple of other ladies too, I forget their names.
There were different, Mrs. Murphy was there. There were a couple of people who came and went very quickly.
Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking, I thought to myself, well, maybe, I was trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they actually thought they were doing what's best for these kids, for their own good, because that's the rationale that they put forth, you know, when they sent these strong-armed guys onto the riverboat. Well, we're doing this for your own good, you know. Maybe they really thought that. And then I said, no, wait a minute. That could have been the case if it wasn't for the money. But this money scheme, you know, they had no intention of doing it for their own good. They were out to make money.
Especially when you, the part of the story where they would go back for more.
Yes.
It wasn't, they weren't satisfied with the first hefty payment.
This is like a blackmail scheme.
Exactly.
You see on a TV show where
the wealthier, the more they raise
right.
the price.
Yeah, you demand a payment from some wealthy philanderer, you know, mm-hmm. you pay us and we won't reveal your affair, and then
I'm sure
2 months later they go back and want more money, you know.
And I'm sure most of the cases, especially in the story that we are reading, the families who did pay for these adoptions were in very vulnerable situations.
Sure.
So they were easily manipulated and blackmailed that way.
Well, as I said, the thought occurred to me, but I quickly dismissed it. And had I seen her picture beforehand, I would never even have thought that. To begin with. So we've told two intriguing stories here. Mm-hmm. You can kind of guess at how at least part of it intersects. But how the heck does Avery in the present day find out about all of this going on back in 1939? There's a chance meeting at a nursing home. Tell us about that, Lori.
Yes. Well, as Avery is being trained or prepared to potentially take over her father's role, she accompanies him or sometimes just acts on his behalf on tours and different press, you know, journeys or whatever. So she happens to find herself at a nursing home. And as she's just standing there with whatever was going on, an older woman comes up to her and basically kind of latches on to her. Not in a violent way, just, you know, just there's something about her that mm-hmm. the woman finds comforting. And she talks to her. The woman refers to her and calls her Fern. And then they leave and go on to their next stop. But they realize, the nursing home realizes that the woman has a dragonfly, a bracelet with dragonflies, and wants it to return it to Avery.
Yeah, she stole Avery's bracelet.
Yes.
While they were talking to each other.
Yeah, it's a little sleight of hand, perhaps.
Now, there's another thing that I should have mentioned before this chance meeting. Avery is interested in her family history.
Yes.
But her grandmother, and boy, I hope I'm not getting the names confused, so gently tell me if I am, Laurie. Her grandmother's Judy.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
Grandma Judy, who is very elderly and is now going through dementia.
Correct.
So there's a family history here that nobody really knows about. Avery is very interested, 30 years old. Her father is ailing.
Yes.
Yeah, I can understand where she'd want to find out a little bit about the family roots and the family tree. But Grandma Judy is going through dementia, so she can't help.
No, not really. If she does, it may just be a faint clue.
Mm-hmm.
Not really a lot of information. Nothing that Avery can really count on to further her pursuit.
So back to the stolen bracelet routine. I don't know whether this was made clear, whether the elderly woman in the nursing home knew what she was doing.
I don't know that that was actually really, I guess that was left to our decision whether she.
It could have been. She just said, oh, look at this nice bracelet and, you know, I'll take it right off this wrist here. But the nursing staff discovers it.
Yes.
They realize that it's Avery's. It's a pretty expensive piece.
And rather unique.
Mm-hmm. And they call her, and she says, I'll come back and get it. I'll come back to the nursing home and retrieve my bracelet.
Yes. And the reason she did that was because it did have family history. It was her grandmother's. And although she didn't really know the origins of the bracelet or the story, she knew that she needed to get it back. Had it been just, you know, an everyday piece, she said she probably wouldn't have bothered. But this had an attachment to the family.
Now, it turns out that there's some sort of a connection between this woman who steals her bracelet, whose name is May, by the way.
Yes.
Some sort of a connection between her and Grandma Judy.
Grandmother. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, Avery just, I don't know, this was a little nebulous to me. Does she just suspect this, feel this? Does May drop a hint or something?
When she went back to pick up her bracelet, she sees a photograph that resembles, there were four ladies, I believe, in the first photograph. There were a couple photographs. It might have been the first one. But there was a family resemblance to her grandmother that she thought initially.
Mm-hmm.
So that piqued her curiosity. And then the conversation that she had with May, although May originally, and they both had their moments, and both suffered dementia to some extent, but obviously at first, I think the initial impression of May was that she had her dementia was much more severe than it really was.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had made a couple of comments that also sparked Avery's curiosity.
So now Avery is on the trail.
Yes.
And, you know, and if you've ever explored your family roots, genealogy, and a lot of people are doing that these days.
Yes.
In fact, a lot of people are going to your library to do this.
Yes, exactly. I was just going to say we have people coming from all over the country. We get requests from all over the world for different things. And when I was reading this and I thought about that, I thought it'd be interesting if they would have had her go to the library.
Oh, especially one like Butler area, which has a tremendous genealogical research department. And by the way, folks, if you're doing this, you can get help. There's staff at the Butler Area Public Library who
Margaret
can help
is
you.
Our special collections genealogist, and she is wonderful. She can find all kinds of things, and people can make appointments with her. You can always stop by, but if you have, you know, certain things that you really want to know about and need some help, she will make an appointment and help you.
And that's upstairs, right?
It is. It's on the second floor.
Yeah. Okay, a little bit parenthetical, but very important that people know. I'm sure some people don't realize that.
That's true.
You have that section there. Okay, what was I talking about? Oh,
on the hunt.
Avery's on the hunt and trying to dig out more information. And fortunately, there are Grandma Judy's has some old day books.
Yes, Grandma Judy was quite the journalist. As far as keeping diaries and day books and all kinds of organization of her life.
Do you know people that do that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I do too. There are people in my family.
I think now, I mean, a lot of people now have switched to electronic versions, maybe perhaps not the pen and paper, but yes.
Not the same.
No.
So she started going through. I mean, Grandma Judy is obviously near the end of her life. She's out of it. She starts going through her old day books, what we would call today, you know, your appointment book, you know, the little book that you keep in your, your planner, your day planner. She starts going through these, and keep in mind now, we're going way, way back, 65, 70 years. She finds a phone number. in there for, and this is sounds a little mysterious, finds a phone number for somebody on Adisto Island.
Yes.
I don't know whether she made that up or not. I never heard of it. But and, of course, on the hunt as she is, she calls the phone number.
Yes, and it happens to be of a realtor.
Mm-hmm. And he says, well, yeah, Trent, I can't read my own writing here, Laurie. Trent Turner.
Yes, Turner.
And it turns out, you know, they have to talk a while. Because, you know, this is a call out of the blue from a total stranger. But it turns out that he had some documents, some confidential documents.
An envelope.
For Grandma Judy.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Which he didn't know what the real contents revealed. But his grandfather had given him an assignment to deliver not just that one, but others as well prior to his death.
His grandfather had the same name, by the way. That's the only time I got confused about the names.
Well, yes, three generations of Trent Turners.
All called Trent Turner.
Correct.
Maybe she just put that in there.
What's your name? Trent Turner, the youngest one, didn't name his son Trent.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So Judy, listen to me. I'm getting confused here.
Avery
decides she's going to go to Adisto Island and get these papers. Maybe there's some. She can finally solve this missing link puzzle in the family genealogy, the family tree. So she goes and she meets. She's talked with Trent Turner on the phone. She meets him in person, and lo and behold, those sparks that weren't flying with Elliot begin to buzz a little bit with Trent.
A little bit, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's a possible future romance here. We don't really know. But he eventually...
She wears him down. She talks him into helping her and providing the information, because he was resistant at first because he was given instructions that they need, this envelope needed to be returned or taken to Grandma Judy, no one else.
Mm-hmm.
The people the envelopes were addressed to, that's who they were to be given to.
But eventually he turns over a birth certificate and adoption papers for a child named Shad Foss.
Yes.
Shad Foss. These are adoption papers from 1939.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Shad, of course, is the boy.
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm.
Which we should say that part of the story, I don't think this is giving away, when they went to the foster or the home, they were given different names.
So we won't tell you the whole denouement here, but we will say, because we've talked about the Queenie having the twins, the premature twins, it turns out that Grandma Judy was one of the twins.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yes. Which that was part of the mystery as well. You knew that Grandma Judy had a tie, and you just weren't quite sure who she was going to end up really being, her real identity.
There are a few more little twists at the end. We'll leave those for people who want to read this book. It's very readable.
It is. It's an easy read as far as the style of writing. It's a little heart-wrenching in places, a little, you know, hard to read. But I think you knowing that you know something's going to happen at the end, you can get through that.
She has a way with words, too, by the way. This is early on in the book. She's describing the sweltering night in late summer. Keep in mind, now, this is in Memphis.
Yes.
Humid, sticky, clammy. It's in the hospital room where the woman
at the beginning of
gives birth to the stillborn child. And she's just talking about the room and then the conditions that night. Outside, the breeze is weary, and the cicadas throb in the tall trees. The screens in the windows sway inward as the attic fan rattles overhead, pulling at wet air that has no desire to be moved. Very descriptive there.
Oh, yes.
You could write five paragraphs and did say that, but to do it in two sentences.
I think she did a wonderful job as far as when they were talking chapters, when Real was talking about experience and living on the river. You really did get a sense. You could picture yourself being with them.
The title of the book is Before We Were Yours. Available, I'm assuming, at least some of our libraries. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, I've got a hard copy. You do, too.
I do, too.
Probably in paperback pretty soon, if
you're
interested.
I would think if it is out shortly.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't take as long as it used to.
No, I was going to say, it used to be you waited and waited, and large print was years down the road. But anymore, within usually the year, or maybe sometimes sooner. So I would think very soon, and probably already electronic, obviously. But
and I only mention that because, books are expensive. Initial hard copy stuff, these days, it's always $25-$30, if not more.
At least.
Yeah.
At least.
And so that's one of the reasons why libraries need our help, folks. But some folks like to wait until the paperback's available. Of course, some folks get it electronically. Get the ebook thing. I've not warmed up to that yet, Laurie. What about you?
I traditionally for novels, I haven't warmed up to that as well. I do read magazines. We have a digital magazine service, and I will read those.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if I'm traveling, I find it easier to do that. And they're expensive as well if you go to purchase those. But I'm not a real big fan yet of reading. I still want the book in my hand. And
I like the physical turning of the page. And one of the, I don't know whether it's Nook or Kindle or
there's so
whatever.
Many. There's so many now.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. But they say we give you the same feeling as turning a page. And that's crazy. It doesn't.
I don't know.
No.
We have touch screens at the library for some of our computers. And the computers don't like my touch. So I'm not sure that that's exactly the same feel.
Well, it could be a generational thing. I'm still a guy that likes a book in my hand. I like to fall asleep in the recliner with the book gently falling onto my face. You know,
I have to say that the majority of the people who come in, they may have both, but they still like the print version.
I can see this becoming a movie.
I can, too.
You know?
I can, too.
It would, to me, at least, it would be a lot more interesting than what was the Girl on the Train? Was that the name of that?
Oh, there are a lot of books with the girl.
There's
a lot of girl books right now. That's one of the popular themes to have girl in the title.
Yeah, they all want to put that in there to take advantage of Girl on a Train.
Exactly.
Which, of course, was a misnomer to begin with because it was a woman on a train. It wasn't a girl at all.
It's very trendy right now.
I didn't like that book, in case you haven't picked up on that.
I had an idea. That might be true.
This is a good read. If not a theatrical film, certainly. Yeah. And Hallmark should eat this up because this is pretty poignant stuff. Before We Were Yours.
Yes.
Lisa Wingate. What about the picture? It's on the Mississippi, right?
It is on the Mississippi, and it's just very heartwarming and just very catching when you look at it. But after you read the story, there's a part of the book that you understand why they selected
two little girls. One looks to be about 6, one maybe about 8. They're sitting on a battered old suitcase. The little one is holding a teddy bear. You're looking at them from the back.
Yes.
You don't see their faces.
Long curls for one, which you often, because of the time period, you're often, the girls are often described with Shirley Temple curls. And then a braid. But definitely you can tell that they are connected. There's a connection between the two.
The author is Lisa Wingate, just like it sounds, Wingate. And Before We Were Yours, New York Times bestseller. Good pick, Laurie.
Thank you.
I'm not saying it's one of my 10 all-time favorite books, but it's a good read. Yeah, it's a good read. And it gets you thinking, too, about some serious questions. Are we too overscheduled in our lives? Do we need to take more time to, for example, go to a disto island?
Yes.
And break my routine and
Yes, that's very true, like because that. Part of the story, this group makes it a point to put family first and spend some quality time together.
Yeah. There's a lot in this book that we didn't get to. Some of it was on purpose, but others just because, you know, we have limited time here
exactly.
to chat. Yeah. Thanks, Lori. Good to see you.
Great to see you, too.
Happy holidays.
Thank you. We're
just seems a little bit early to say Merry Christmas,
I know. We're getting ready for our light-up night at the library on Friday, and we're all bustling around. It's like, gee, December's almost here. We got to get ready.
What's going to happen there?
This is the fourth year we've had our library light-up night, and we will have our tree. We will be lighting that. Santa will be there. We have a hot chocolate bar, crafts. Games, you know, it's just a great family time.
Open to the general public?
It is, from 6 to 8.
Mm-hmm. And that's this Friday.
Yes, we're hoping for some seasonal weather. Sometimes, you know, 60-degree weather is just not exactly...
Well, the long-range forecast says maybe some wet snow.
Maybe.
Friday.
Maybe.
A little bit, not
just
enough
Just a little
to...
bit, just, you know, to get everyone in the Christmas spirit, the holiday mood.
Butler Area Public Library. And what time is that again?
6 to 8.
6 to 8 this Friday. Mm-hmm. Lori Hinterleiter is director of the Butler Area Public Library. Always a pleasure to have her with us.
Great to visit again.
Can I give you this book back?
Sure.
I'm not quite sure which library it came from.
It might have come from Kathy.
You can figure that out and get it back to where
yes,
it belongs
from Kathy,
for me.
I can do that.
Thanks. We'll take a quick break. Up next, the maestro, Matthew Kramer, joins us by telephone. He's not in Butler yet. He will be, though, in a couple of days because the Butler Symphony has its holiday concert this coming Saturday evening, and we'll find out all about it from Matthew Kramer coming up here on It's Your Turn on WISR in just a moment or so. Does your pharmacy tell you your wait time for a prescription will take a half an hour or longer, or maybe won't even be ready until the next day? Don't think this is your only option. At Institute Hill Pharmacy, we have made it a priority to take care of our customers' needs first because your time is precious. Most wait times are under 10 minutes. So don't you think it's time to make a switch to Institute Hill Pharmacy? Located at 937 East Jefferson Street, or find us on Facebook. Institute Hill Pharmacy, an old-fashioned pharmacy just the way you remember.
Music is a bridge between the material and the spiritual. My name is Harvey Lauer, and I'm 82. As a blind person, you have to be aware that nobody can tell you what you can or can't do. You really have to try things. My folks got me a little radio in 1940, and that was the best Christmas present I ever got. When I was 11 years old is when I started to play music, play the piano, and then the accordion, and then the cello. My wife, who was also blind, was a good cook. When she died, that's when I started Meals on Wheels. America, let's do lunch.
It's Meals on Wheels.
1 in 6 seniors faces the threat of hunger, and millions more live in isolation. Drop off a hot meal and say a quick hello. Volunteer for Meals on Wheels by donating your lunch break at americaletsdolunch.org. This message brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back, good friends. It's the Thanksgiving Monday edition of It's Your Turn. The holiday season is officially underway now that Thanksgiving has come and gone, and it'll really be underway this weekend with the annual holiday concert of the Butler County Symphony Orchestra. We're very pleased to talk once again on this segment of the It's Your Turn program with Matthew Kramer. He is the musical director and conductor of the Butler Symphony. Matthew, nice to have you with us again.
Great to be with you, Dave.
The holiday concert is this coming Saturday. I'm right on that, correct?
That is correct. It's hard to believe Thanksgiving's already gone, and we're well into the holiday season here.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, some folks might not have their Christmas tree up yet or their poinsettia out, but it's purposeful that the Symphony Association puts the holiday concert early in December. Quite frankly, people get pretty overwhelmed if you wait a couple of weeks down the road, right, Matthew?
It's absolutely correct. Even with the convenience of online shopping anymore, of course, with school activities, family engagements, and just, you know, the frantic pace that the holidays always seem to kind of jolt all of us into, it is nice to be able to spend the early part of it together as a community and singing our favorite carols together. So we like it very much the first Saturday of December.
This is one of the most popular concerts year in and year out. It has been from the very beginning. And there are some special treats this year for the holiday concert. You will have some local choirs, some high school singers, Matthew.
That's correct. And I think this is the third year that we've invited the Butler High School Chorus, in addition to Seneca Valley's singers, to join us together in the program. We combine both choruses together. Many of the schools are familiar with each other, and you know it's great for them to be together and to catch up with one another. But really, just to be able to sing in one kind of massed chorus really produces a really brilliant effect. Brings a lot of people into the audience who might not come to the other five concerts during the season, but like you mentioned, this is our most popular concert of the season because of the holiday nature of it, some of the familiar tunes, and you know we always strive to add new selections there as well. So the chorus is a big staple of this program.
And what a thrill for these high school kids to be able to perform on stage with the symphony. I know I would have been thrilled to do that in high school.
I hear it from so many of the students that they've never sung with a full-size symphony orchestra, let alone a professional orchestra. And it just, as much as we say, you know, the incredible stereo quality of recordings and in movies, nothing really rivals a concert live. And to be able to hear, for these students, that orchestra wrapped around them, to feel the vibrations of a bass drum, to be able, you know, the trumpet is seated 2 feet away, it really is an eye-opening experience for those students who are doing it for the very first time, and something that we hope sticks with them as they continue to grow.
Now, I'm looking at the program here, Matthew, and it says Butler Senior High School Ensembles and the Seneca Valley Madrigal Singers. So these will be select groups from the two high schools. I'm guessing the creme de la creme of the high school singers, the high school voices.
That's right. They're selected by their respective directors. Of course, Brian Helfel is a very important part of the musical fabric in Butler. He plays in the Butler County Symphony. He's a pianist and just does wonderful work there with the young singers, Butler High School. And Aaron McGill, the director down at Seneca Valley, has been with us for, this is the second year that Seneca has been with us, and has really enjoyed the experience that this offers for his students, again, to be able to sing with an orchestra live and you know, to be able to join a large chorus. We do really have some exceptional young singers, and we're delighted about that.
So what are the high school singers going to perform? What's on the program for them?
We have a selection from the Polar Express, which remains one of the most popular animated films for young people. Of course, I watch it probably about 57 times during the course of the year with my five-year-old. He always seems to have it on, regardless if it's the 4th of July or Easter. He just loves the Polar Express. The selection from that is Song Believe, which was recorded by Josh Groban and is immensely popular. It's a beautiful orchestration. The music is by Alan Silvestri, who wrote the music for everything in Polar Express. He's one of the important film composers. One of my favorite scores of his is Back to the Future. So, you know, this goes, Alan Silvestri's work in Hollywood goes back decades. They'll also join us for another movie selection, Somewhere in My Memory, from Home Alone. This is a great film score by John Williams, whose name just seems to pop up everywhere when it comes to music from Star Wars, Superman. But he did write the music for that Macaulay Culkin movie from the 80s, Home Alone. And then two big works that we have, and I can talk about these a little more, and like we're showing the animated film The Snowman, which has a musical selection in there for voice. In addition, they'll wrap up the program with the music from the How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the animated cartoon from the 60s, which this great music on that, they'll be singing along with a wonderful baritone, of course, the title song, You Are Mean One, Mr. Grinch. So, got these kids very much involved from beginning to end of the program.
You know, I have to mention the soundtrack from Home Alone. I had a choral director, a good friend of mine, the late Bob McGinnis. You would not have known him, Matthew, because he passed away before you came to Butler. A great musical talent. We were talking one day about, in fact, it was here on the program, about, you know, do you have a favorite Christmas song, or what do you really like? And he sent me a copy of the soundtrack from Home Alone, and he said, I know you're not going to believe this, because everybody thinks of this as a funny, funny movie. And whether you can't stand Macaulay Culkin or not, it was a very, very funny movie. He said, the music is fantastic. And he really opened my eyes and my ears to that. So I'll be anxious to hear some of that at the concert Saturday night.
It is incredible music, and I will always say that when I was a child, that movie came out, and I thought it was the greatest thing, a kid who was at home by himself and could do whatever he wanted. And now that I'm a parent of two young boys, I just realized that those parents in that movie were really, really bad parents leaving their kid when they went to Europe. So, but it is the music, you're absolutely correct. John Williams at his best.
Now, you're also screening The Snowman. This is not the first time that the Butler's Symphony Orchestra has been involved with playing a soundtrack while a movie is being screened for the live audience. This is pretty exciting, isn't it?
It really is, and this is a classic that I've had the opportunity to do several times. And for your listeners who aren't familiar, Howard Blake wrote the film score for this animated film. The story, The Snowman, was written by Raymond Briggs. And this is an adaptation, a short film about 25 minutes in length of The Snowman, about a boy who, on one snow day goes out and builds the snowman, and magically the snowman comes to life, and they have these wonderful adventures together, and they go to the North Pole and come back. And the music is really, really beautiful. And there's a song in the middle that does use the chorus called Walking in the Air, which is most famous. But you're right, we have done at the Butler County Symphony on numerous occasions film with live orchestral accompaniment, whether it was the Chaplin movie that we screened several years ago or the Disney film along with it. We've done, obviously, cycle in concert, so a number of different formats with film. And as we've talked about on numerous occasions, it's immensely popular with orchestras nowadays to be able to use that as a means of, attracting people who are very interested in film and in film scores as well. So this is a 25-minute example of a wonderful animated cartoon that was nominated for numerous awards, including its film score by Howard Blake, a very beautiful film.
Now, fill me in, because you mentioned The Polar Express, and that's another film, right? Another holiday film.
That's right, and I believe The Polar Express, it's coming in on 20 years now, I think. Of course, Tom Hanks played numerous roles in that film, but I believe it was the first first animated film that used actual human beings to record the animation. What I mean is, I don't know the name of the technology, but where they stick those little balls on the human being to record their music, mm-hmm. and then they did the digital animation on top of those movements. And, of course, now that's used in so many different films that are out now to record the graphics, to record the animation. But it is a classic children's book, which, again, I read to my son regularly, which was turned into a film, and it remains immensely popular. And also because of its film music, we have played the Polar Express suite at least every other year. So this year we're just extracting one song, Believe, and offering that to our chorus. To pitch in on the concert.
Listeners, are you getting the idea that this is a pretty good family affair, the upcoming holiday concert by the Butler Symphony? Indeed it is. Lots for adults, too. In fact, there's lots more that's going to happen this Saturday night at the concert, including performance by a well-known individual, a Butler native, and a great baritone. And we'll talk about that in just a moment or so as we continue our conversation with Matthew Kramer, the musical director and conductor of the symphony, and we'll pick up our conversation with him in just a moment. I wanted to tell you about our good friends at Cummings Candy and Coffee Shop, Main Street, downtown Butler. Two other locations now, too, in case you weren't aware of that. They offer corporate orders of custom gift boxes that make great holiday gifts for clients. And you can choose from an assortment of different ideas. Chocolate-covered chips, I've given those as gifts at holiday time. People love them. Also pretzels, chocolate-covered graham crackers, cherry cordials. You could add a half-pound bag of Butler's own proprietary blend of coffee, the Main Street Roast from Cummings. What else would they call it? It's roasted right there, by the way, at the Main Street location. If you're interested in these gift ideas, call Barry Cummings. He can give you more information on these corporate orders. 724-287-3287. Barry Cummings. Cummings Candy and Coffee Shop has been in the Butler area since 1905. They've been at that Main Street location for almost that long, over a century. Now, there are other locations now, too. They're at Butler Memorial Hospital and the newest Cummings, Cummings West on Route 68, Evans City Road. Open 7 days a week. Ah, boy, just talking about Cummings makes me hungry. And what atmosphere when you visit under the red and white awning on North Main Street in downtown Butler. Cummings, candy, and a coffee. We're chatting with Matthew Kramer. Matthew is the musical director and conductor of the Butler Symphony. I mentioned before the break, Matthew, we have a great baritone, a Butler native, who's going to be joining the orchestra this Saturday evening, Michael Mara. Do you know Mike?
It's to be the first time I've had the opportunity to work with him, but I know him, of course, by a reputation. Like you mentioned, being a Butler native, and has done really very impressive work, and now to have him back in Butler and joining us on this program, we're thrilled. He's going to be presented and How the Grinch Stole Christmas. He'll be our narrator, taking us through this beloved Dr. Seuss classic. And all of the music, as I mentioned earlier, the chorus will be singing, you know, every musical selection from that great 1966 animated classic. And Michael will be doing his great Boris Karloff impersonation. He narrates, and of course he sings You Are Mean One, Mr. Grinch, which is a staple in the holiday repertoire.
Can't wait to see him do that. Michael's been on the program with us on occasion. Most recently, he was doing something at the Strand Theater in Zelianople. It's a couple of years ago. I don't remember the name of the show. A lot of folks will know him from long, long ago when he got his start at the Butler Musical Theater Guild. And it comes from a great musical family, too. It'll be good to see Michael Mara again on Saturday night. And, boy, what else? Oh, surely you're going to have a little bit of Leroy Anderson in there, even just a little snippet, to Matthew.
You can't get through the holiday season without something from Leroy Anderson. That is absolutely right. And he actually bookends our program. We always have a festive opener, something to really kickstart the program. And his Christmas festival is about as good as it comes. It's a five-minute medley, of course, of the staples, the traditional holiday tunes. And Leroy Anderson was really, we've talked on numerous occasions about his work, a master orchestrator, of course, during his long association with the Boston Pops. He was responsible for so many of these little musical miniatures, three-minute pieces like The Waltzing Cat or The Typewriter or Horse and Buggy. But he was also great, of course, at the holiday season and Christmas festival. And, of course, Sleigh Ride, his most famous and ubiquitous selection, are both present on our program.
I can remember doing that when I was in high school, a band and orchestra. And I remember a couple of things about it in particular, fabulous trumpet parts throughout much of that, and also the percussion section. The percussion section gets to go wild during this. And I can remember that I was not a percussionist, but I can remember the kids that I was in high school with, they couldn't wait to do this and make all the sound effects. My guess is that even musicians in the Butler Symphony in the percussion section get smiles on their faces when they're doing this particular piece.
They do, and that's just the nature of Anderson's music, I find. There's no pretense in it whatsoever. It doesn't go on any longer than it needs to. It's full of beautiful melody, the colors in the orchestra, the effects, like you mentioned, you know, whether it's the trumpet with the horse call at the very end or the sound of the whip and the sleigh bells in the percussion section. You know, we've got this delightful little tune that everyone knows, and then, you know, Anderson takes it kind of through different variations, including a big band flourish at the end. So, and within 3 minutes, you get a gem of a work. And that's why it's performed by every orchestra across the country this time of year. Playwright is just a masterpiece.
I'm just looking down through the program for this Saturday night's concert, Matthew. I see Carol of the Bells on here. We haven't talked about that yet, have we?
No, that's another one of those classics, I'll say, because you hear it regularly in several different versions. Maybe the most popular now is by the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, you know, with electric guitar and in a real rock and roll kind of version. But this is by a Russian composer named Leon Tovich, and it's a traditional carol that is quite old, and has been, again, like I said, through several different variations. This one is interesting. Richard Heyman, was another arranger for the Boston Pops, a quite known pop, well-known Pops conductor. And so any arranger, when they arrange Care of the Bells, they have to put their own special spin on it because it's not a long tune at all. It's just very much a repetition. So what Richard Heyman does is he gets very creative and it intersperses at least a dozen other Christmas carols inside of it. And they're very carefully woven so that you always hear the original Carol of the Bells, but all of a sudden Silent Night might pop up for about two bars. Then we get the Good King Wenceslas for two measures. So it's a very interesting arrangement and very well done, too, by a composer who has a real gift at arranging, Richard Heyman.
Believe it or not, folks, there's still a couple of more things on the program for what looks to be a really marvelous concert this Saturday night. Bruce Chase Christmas Favorites. What are we talking about there, Matthew?
We're talking about more some of the upbeat Christmas carols, Pine Cones and Holly Berries, which is the official name of It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas.
Hmm.
That's a classic because it does come from Broadway by the great composer Meredith Wilson, who also wrote, of course, Music Man. But that's a little bit of the music trivia there. What it, It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas is not actually the name of the song. It's Pine Cones and Holly Berries. Silver Bells is also on that arrangement by Bruce Chase. And then I believe the last, I've got to grab the score that's on the floor here. I think the last selection is, I won't be able to find it now, but just a popular selection from musical theater. Oh, it's the Christmas song, of course, Mel Torme classic.
Oh, yes, Mel Torme.
So, you know, in addition to the wonderful Jingle Bells and Hark the Herald, the traditional carols, we do have some of those that are a little bit more modern, even though we're still talking about a couple decades old here, some of the more popular classics from either Broadway or from, you know, great singers.
Mel Torme wrote the Christmas song, which is the official title for Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire. I've heard so many other people do it, and I very seldom say this, but I think Tony Bennett and a couple of other people actually do a little better job on it than Mel Torme in terms of performing, you know. But, you know, Mel Torme, what a great writer. You mentioned Meredith Wilson, author of The Music Man, and I did not know that he had written that particular Christmas song. There's also a Christmas song in the Judy Garland film from way back when, Meet Me in St. Louis. And this is a little trivia that always catches people by surprise. The wonderful song, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, that comes from that film, that movie.
That's right. Judy Garland. A little bit of trivia here, the number of musical selections that do come from Broadway theater.
Yeah. Hey, there's one more thing here, and it's a Hanukkah suite. Tell us a little bit about that, Matthew.
This one is arranged by Jeff Tyzik, who is a very well-known Pops conductor and a marvelous musician, I'll add. Jeff Tyzik is the Pops conductor of the Rochester Philharmonic, Dallas Symphony, Seattle Symphony, and I believe about five other orchestras. So he's in many different places, an incredible trumpet player. But to be a very fine Pops conductor, you also have to have the arranging chops. You have to be able to, you know, like a Richard Heyman or like a Leroy Anderson, you have to be able to write music for the orchestra to play. If there's a song that you want to cover and there's no version for orchestra, you have to write it yourself. So Jeff is very gifted in that capacity. He's arranged numerous works, and he's a composer on top of that. But this Hanukkah suite is one of the best to pay, obviously, homage to that holiday, which runs alongside the Advent calendar, that we want to include our friends in the Jewish community, that these really fantastic selections in about an 8-minute arrangement that really showcases the orchestra very, very well, with solos in many different sections, and then the orchestra at its full force. We've done it, I think this is the second time since I've been music director. Again, it is one of the classics.
And it's very nice for people who may not have been exposed to any Hanukkah music to hear this. I know I'm an unabashed fan of Carole King, and on her holiday CD that came out, oh gosh, must be 4 or 5 years ago now, she has a Hanukkah song on there that just blows me away. Gorgeous, gorgeous piece. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's the lineup. Folks, what a lineup for the concert this coming Saturday night, the holiday concert for the Butler County Symphony Orchestra. Holiday traditions is the theme of the concert. Surely you don't have time for a pre-concert lecture, Matthew. There's too much stuff going on here in the concert.
That's very true. This is the one concert of the season where we do not have a pre-concert lecture, and it's really not required at all that these pieces, whether they're the traditional carols or sleigh ride or pieces that we perform almost annually, or the new selections as well, you know, we just, I think that there's enough there for the audience to come in and enjoy a little bit of the holiday season with the sounds of our music. And like you said, it is a tradition. We just enjoy jump-starting the holiday season here in the Butler community and seeing so many friendly faces joining us for this concert.
It's a busy weekend for the Butler Symphony folks. They've got the holiday tour of homes during the day on Saturday, which is a major fundraiser for the symphony. And then, of course, the holiday traditions concert that night. And you'll also have your annual basket raffle at the concert this Saturday night, which is another important fundraiser for the symphony. It takes a lot of money to keep a symphony going, doesn't it, Matthew?
No, it is not not run on good wishes and hope, that's for sure. That we have a lot of people working on behind the scenes, and an incredible board that works tirelessly to ensure that fundraising meets its goal and that we can continue to put on the great music that our community likes to hear. And the community support, Dave, we've talked about that on numerous occasions. It's amazing always to me that a community the size of Butler is able to support an orchestra as fine as the symphony. And our musicians know that, and they appreciate that greatly.
You can check with the symphony office on the Diamond downtown for ticket availabilities. Certainly for this concert, folks, don't wait until the last minute because you are very likely to be disappointed. The symphony office is on the Diamond at 259 South Main Street, or you can check online at butlersymphony.org. The musical director and conductor of the Butler Symphony, Matthew Kramer, has been our guest. Matthew, always nice to talk with you, and happy holidays to you. We look forward to seeing you this Saturday night.
And to you as well, Dave. Thank you.
Sure. So long now. Matthew Kramer, maestro, and very, very popular. He's done some amazing things with the Butler Symphony over the past several years. We are going to take a quick break to check lottery numbers. We'll be back to wrap up the Monday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR right after these words.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 5353. The pick 3 is 619619. Pick 4, 5144. The pick 5, 87407. The wild ball is 8. Treasure hunt 4, 5, 6, 8, and 27. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $30,000.
You and your family are invited to attend the Thompson Miller 17th Annual Remembrances, Tinsels, and Tears Candlelight Memorial Service on Tuesday, December 5th at 7 o'clock in the evening at the Mount Chestnut Presbyterian Church, 727 West Old Route 422 in nearby Mount Chestnut. Holiday time can be difficult, especially after experiencing the recent death of someone you love. We want to support you to remember the life of your loved one during this holiday season. The Acts Choir will be joining us again this year, and there is no charge. Our special remembrance tree in memory of loved ones who have died is on display throughout December at Thompson Miller Funeral Home in downtown Butler. Please join us on Tuesday, December 5th at 7 o'clock in the evening at the Mount Chestnut Presbyterian Church, 727 Old Route 422 in nearby Mount Chestnut, easily handicap accessible. For information about purchasing a remembrance ornament in memory of your loved one, visit our website at www.thompson-miller.com. The name of your loved one will be recognized at the service, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Thank our guests on the program today, certainly Maestro Matthew Kramer, just chatting with us, and earlier, Laurie Hinterleiter, who's the director of the Butler Area Public Library, for a book talk today. Coming up next month, our book talk selection is Finding Noel. Well, that's appropriate for just before Christmas. North Trails Public Library will be here to discuss Finding Noel by Richard Paul Evans. Coming up on tomorrow's program, among other guests, David Cord, the director of VA Butler Healthcare, will be visiting with us tomorrow. We have some open talk time as well and some other surprises for you also. I'm Dave Malarkey. Enjoy the rest of your Monday, and we'll see you tomorrow on It's Your Turn here on WISR starting at 12:30. Don't forget, program note, it's a hockey night in Pittsburgh, and there'll be Penguin hockey tonight as the Penguins host the Philadelphia Flyers. Mike Lang calling the live radio play-by-play. Airtime here on WISR for Penguin warm-up tonight, 6:30 from PPG Paints Arena. The Penguins and the Flyers tonight.
This is your station for the Pittsburgh Steelers, WISR Butler.
CBS News, I'm Pam Coulter.
To all of you.